And welcome back. So much has been written about Christmas and the holiday spirit, ranging from A Christmas Carol Scrooge to The Gift of the Magi. In most, the true spirit of the season prevails. We have two examples for you. One relates to the day after Christmas, the other to the night before. We start with a Christmas classic, A Visit from St. Nicholas, known to most of us as The Night Before Christmas, Clement Moore's classic, loved by young and old alike. Members of our staff here at St. Louis Public Radio joined me in this reading. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer.
With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too.
And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof, as I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow.
The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
The staff of St. Louis Public Radio. Some years ago, I wrote a poem inspired by a young relative who looked up when the dust had cleared on Christmas morning, looking for even more presents to open. "Is that all there is?" he asked. It occurred to the adults that it was time for him to learn that the day is about a lot more than opening presents. Here's how I wrote about it in my poem, The Day After Christmas. Boxes piled high and ribbons askew, pretty paper that once had been new. The tree in the corner, the lights now turned out, the room otherwise empty, no children about. The toys they had scattered amid the debris were left to themselves, except two or three which the youngsters had taken as favorite treasures upstairs to their rooms for their own private pleasures. For mother and father, a chance to relax before putting the paper in cartons and stacks. The parents were happy with all they had done. The children tore through it, all in great fun. And if the measure of Christmas is the size of the mess, then this day indeed could be called a success. For the daughter of eight, there'd been memories born she'd carry forever of this Christmas morn. But up in his room, midst his robots and such, a boy of just 10 thought he'd not gotten much. Not enough, anyway. Not all he'd demanded in all of those appeals to Mom, Dad, and Santa. There were things that he had wanted not under the tree, so Christmas for him was not all it could be. He'd gotten his games and electronic things, well-batteried monsters with loud buzzers and pings, a Swiss Army knife, cowboy boots, and a sweater. But the little boy, Johnny, thought he should have done better. So he moped in his room and felt downright sad, even felt angry with Mom, Santa, and Dad. And speaking of Santa, now Johnny believed that over the years he'd been greatly deceived, for if Santa existed, that would have been that. He'd have gotten that TV and real cowboy hat. But no TV or hat were placed under the tree. The gifts he most wanted were just not to be. He told all who would listen what rang tops on his list. How was it possible they had been missed? So he sat in his room with ambitions unmet and forgot all about all he did get. He grew sullen and angry and frustrated too. He pouted and blamed and felt terribly blue. He thought back on the morning and this day he anointed the worst Christmas of all. He was most disappointed. With the family at dinner, he was hard-pressed to conceal it, that feeling he had, but he wouldn't reveal it. Mom looked at Dad and one to the other. Even his sister wondered about brother. But he sat there in silence and said not a word. His father, impatient, thought this was absurd. It's Christmas, he thought, and Johnny's done well. What in the world could be causing this spell? He asked, "What's wrong, son? Not feeling so hot?" But Johnny had just shifted. He'd been put on the spot. He pushed at his food, dinner hardly completed, and he knew Dad's question would soon be repeated. He didn't wait long. Dad spelled it right out. "Come on, Johnny," he said. "What's this all about?" So he put down his fork, and like a dam burst, he blurted to all, "This day's been the worst." Dad looked at Mom and the little girl, too, and no one knew quite what to do. The heat swelled in Johnny, red covered his face. He wished none of this day had in fact taken place. He'd said what he said, and he knew he'd regret it, and he wished beyond wish that all might forget it. But the next words were Dad's, measured and strong. "Johnny," he said, "what in God's name is wrong?" His words cut like a pin, stabbing a bubble. Johnny knew that his future held nothing but trouble. He took a deep breath. He took all the strength that he had. But he had to explain why this day was so bad. The string of his words was for moments unbroken. No one at the table could believe what was spoken. A 10-year-old boy with a room full of toys, the envy of most of the world's girls and boys, sat there full blushing in an obvious huff, and he told them quite clearly he'd not gotten enough. His father sat silent. His mother did too. Johnny shifted uneasily, wondering what they would do. He could see their unhappiness, their deep disappointment. In a voice like a whisper, Dad said, "We have an appointment. I'm sorry, my boy, you feel so let down, but tomorrow at 9, we're going downtown. You must learn about Christmas, that it's not all receiving, that Christmas is love, it's giving, believing. You've been misdirected, and it saddens me, son. Perhaps it's the job your mother and I've done. You have more than most, and today you got more. I'm tempted to take it all back to the store. You're missing the point, son, about what this day's about. Tomorrow at 9, you and I will go out." No more was said. Dinner ended in gloom, and Johnny was happy to slink to his room. He knew Dad was angry that Mother was sad, and he knew very clearly that he had been bad. He slowly undressed, complete in his sorrow, and he wondered what Dad had in mind for tomorrow. Sleep didn't come easily. He tossed and he dreamed, but morning came quickly, too quickly it seemed. He woke, washed and dressed, and ate with the rest, and if pressed would have gladly confessed that it was wrong what he'd said. He'd not used his head. He honestly wished at one point he were dead. The minutes passed slowly, and the clock on the wall showed no indication of movement, no, none at all. His father said little as he buttered his toasts, and Mom was more silent on this day than most. It was an awful wait for a fateful date, and if time moved at all, it was slow. But the agony ended, suspense was suspended, when Dad turned to him saying, "Let's go." The snow squeaked neath their boots as they walked to the car. Johnny was glad that the walk wasn't far. When they pulled out in the street, he saw it was snowing, but he hadn't a clue as to where they were going. They drove mostly in silence. Not 10 words were spoken, and the little boy's wondering only was broken when Dad parked on a parking lot being cleared of the snow. Only then was it clear as to where they would go. The hospital. But why? His curiosity heightened. Then the feeling he had was the feeling of frightened. He'd seen this building before, but he'd not been inside. He knew sick people went there, and that some sometimes died. They walked from the car and approached the front door. An ambulance passed with a wail and a roar. Now Johnny was worried and wished he could run. Run from his father and what Dad thought must be done. A few seconds later, they stood square in the lobby. Johnny's knees shook. They felt rubbery and knobby. He stared at the floor and wished he could holler. His father stood by and brushed snow from his collar. The flakes fluttered downward, gently striking the tile, and became tiny puddles in a very short while. But Johnny just stared, eyes fixed, pointed down. They soon focused on shoes, a pair, shiny and brown. His eyes slid slowly upward till they fixed on a face. He thought he'd be frightened, but that wasn't the case. His father was watching, then said, "Johnny, I think that it's time that you met the good Dr. Frink." Frink's eyes didn't smile as he looked at the lad. Johnny was sure Frink knew he'd been bad, but he stuck out his hand, as he'd been taught was just right, and he hoped that this stranger thought he was polite. Frink's eyes caught the father's as if he wanted to smile. His expression told Dad that he liked the boy's style, but Johnny was bashful and he didn't see. And he visibly jumped when Frink said, "Come with me." He looked at his father and Dad, nodded yes, though where they were going was anyone's guess. But the doctor and Dad, they certainly knew what lay ahead, what they all soon would do. They walked as a threesome down the long winding halls, up some stairs, through big doors, past spotless white walls. After 10 minutes or so, when they'd walked very far, Frink said, "Johnny, do you have any idea how lucky you are? Even with Christmas that turned out so bad, it was better by far than the one my kids had. Some are quite sick and in a very bad way. Christmas for them was just one more day. Most got nice presents, shiny and new, and in a moment you'll meet one or two. But none of them got what they really had sought, because what they wanted just can't be bought." The words fell on Johnny like blows from a hammer. He wanted to talk, but he knew he'd just stammer. He looked at the doctor, his dad, Frink again. If he'd been more nervous before, he didn't know when. He could sense what was coming. He could feel the alarm. And it was at this very moment that he realized the harm and the hurt his selfishness brought, the first part of the lesson he was about to be taught. Dad put his hand on his shoulder and squeezed once or twice, and Johnny would always remember how it felt awfully nice as a gesture of confidence for one nearing his doom, and it helped as the three of them entered a room. As they stepped through the door, he hesitated a fraction, for there was a girl strapped and in traction. Her leg was held high by long wires and bars. Her secret concern was that there would be scars. For Jenny, her name was, had come to believe that her dreams of the dance were dashed Christmas Eve. A fall in her house in an unusual way had caused her a terrible Christmas day. She was the same age as Johnny, a girl about 10, but even at that age, yes, even then, dreams of dancing on stage, film, or TV had gone to the land of might never be. During the visit, it was never made plain that she was entertaining the trio in a great deal of pain, but she smiled at her doctor, at Johnny, and Dad, and said that she didn't feel all that bad. They chatted a while and joked with good cheer, and she was the first to wish Happy New Year. As they left, she watched Johnny with the look of a gnome. "You're so lucky," she said, "to have had Christmas at home." "I know," he admitted as he pressed his dad's hand, "but you'll soon be home and it'll be grand." They waved through the door and re-entered the hall, and Johnny lamented that she'd had that bad fall. "She'll be here for weeks," said Frank as they talked. "Very bad luck," said Dad while they walked. In a few minutes' time, at a door open wide, they heard lusty laughter quite clearly inside. The doctor entered, breaking out a wide grin. The response was immediate, of course. "Come in." They did as was bid and all stepped to the bed. There, surrounded by pillows propped under his head, was a boy known as Billy, who hailed from a farm. And to see him and think, there's no cause for alarm. But Johnny knew better. The boy had to be ill. And as if on a signal, Bill was handed a pill. He was quite sick, though you'd be hard-pressed to know it, because neither he nor his family in any way showed it. They laughed and they shouted, and throughout the confusion, there was no way Johnny could tell. It was all an illusion, no hint whatsoever, that to cure Billy's affliction would take the doctor's best work and divine interdiction. Johnny and Billy talked about the things that boys do, about football and hockey, sports they both knew. The moments passed quickly and the family joined in. People passing the doorway were impressed by the din. When the doctor achieved what he hoped to achieve, he touched the boy's shoulder, saying it was time to leave. They left the room trailed by cheers of the season, and if you'd been there, you'd have thought there's no reason to worry or fret about the gang down the hall. No reason to worry, no reason at all. But the doctor explained as they walked briskly away that Billy might never again be able to play. He'd be lucky to do anything ever with ease, for he suffered a terrible, life-threatening disease. And, Frank revealed, Billy's gift Christmas Day was word that extended his hospital stay. Frank bent down to Johnny, nose to nose, toe to toe. "Johnny, there's something I think you should know. Billy had just one Christmas request," he softly said, "never to return to his hospital bed. He didn't want toys, a football, or paint, just the chance to end a lifelong complaint and be healthy and strong like any young boy, a chance to live life that most people enjoy. That's all he wanted for Christmas, but he'll never get it. His family and I will always regret it. Some things, Johnny, you'll learn just aren't meant to be. And as a doctor, it always has bothered me. I can give comfort and medicine and at times reassure them, but one thing I can't do, I simply can't cure him." "But he was laughing," said Johnny. "His family was, too." "At this point in his life, it can't be easy to do," said the doctor, now upset and distressed. "In spite of it all, young Billy's been blessed. He's a giver of joy, a fine little boy. His family is wonderful, too. They have each other, kids, father and mother. Loving, in fact, is now all they can do. They have love of family and prayers on their side, but with a sickness like Billy's, there's no place to hide. So they take life as it's given, laughter and pain, and I've never heard one of them ever complain." Johnny nodded at Dad, a tear slipped from his eye. He now understood clearly that Billy might die. "Can I give him my presents? Can I give him my toys? Can I do anything for him? He's the nicest of boys." Johnny was desperate, wanted badly to give. He wanted to do something to help Billy live, or if that was impossible, to help make life more pleasant. He'd gladly turn over his each Christmas present. Frank looked at the father and gave him a nod. "The boys learned something today, and we can thank God. A hard lesson, my son," Dad said with a smile, "one we all need to remember once in a while." Frank had planned other visits as part of the tour, but the point had been made, the response had been pure. There are more children here, some worse and some better. And Frink asked, what about Jenny? Did you forget her? No, I haven't, said Johnny. Can't I help her some, too? Dad said, I have an idea, son, but it'll be up to you. Take some of your toys you have all in creation and consider making some kind of donation. The sick youngsters here, some are quite needy. To have all that you have almost seems greedy. For some of the kids here, a little pleasure or laughter is all they can hope for. It's all that they're after. But it's up to you, Johnny. Do what you think best. Dr. Frink and I can take care of the rest. By now, Johnny's face was awash with his tears, for he'd learned something today beyond his 10 years. A lesson in life that some never see. Some things can't be placed neath the Christmas tree. Unlike computers or hats or baseball bats, some things can't be purchased by power or wealth. As Johnny now knows, and as you might suppose, the most precious of gifts are love, life, and good health. Well, that's a poem I wrote several years ago, reflecting on the day after Christmas, which is sometimes as interesting as Christmas Day itself, especially when young relatives are not happy with the gifts that they had received. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Kim Oswalt, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Don Marsh. On behalf of the entire St. Louis On the Air team, we all wish you the happiest of holiday seasons.